You're listening to KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
About a 28th Amendment to make it clear that corporations do not have the same rights as people. Would that be an incentive to stop corporate negligence? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. That's one idea about how to deal with the fact that the Supreme Court reduced the Exxon Valdez punitive damages award. What's yours? Our number is 1-800-478-8255, toll free, that's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org. We're talking oil spills and the culture of the law on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
There are a few things which united Alaskans as much as the event in March of 1989 when that tanker went aground and spilled all that oil. You saw the governor and even to some degree the legislature, and you saw Alaskans of all sorts feeling this, and then it spread across the entire nation. You know, lo, these many years later, the checks are finally coming out, and they're vastly reduced from what was once the largest civil damage award ever awarded by a court, a federal one anyway. It was shrunk down, and those checks are beginning to go out now. So that happened because the Supreme Court reduced the punitive damages award. Tom Lockish joins us by telephone. Tom personally tried to clean up the spill and personally litigated for his right to clean up the spill, and has ever since 1989 has never ceased to try and make it a little bit less likely that we'll have another spill. Tom, welcome to Talk Alaska. How you doing, man?
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. Good morning, listeners. The problem extends far beyond just the remedies for damage, but it extends to a legal process for preventing and responding to spills, in that both the federal government and state government seem to have inherent conflicts of interest in how they enforce their oil spill prevention and response laws. The Coast Guard has taken upon itself to promote shipping interests and therefore refuses to enforce its laws. Most notably, you'll see the Selendang IU and the fact that there are still tankers transiting our waters without proper spill plans. But the state itself is in the oil business, and it has exerted, the administration and the Department of Revenue has exerted undue influence upon the regulatory agency, Department of Environmental Conservation, in administration of the regulations, which by and large are fairly comprehensive. The in essence, because we're part of the oil industry, the state revenues are reduced by about 25% for each dollar we spend on oil spill prevention and response. So the Department of Environmental Conservation has been prohibited from fully enforcing its regulations, which would require much better and more equipment to prevent and respond to oil spills.
So Tom, how do we?
I got the answer to all that, because it's all part of a larger problem. This whole thing about undue influence on our regulatory agencies, undue influence of corporations on our elections, on our judges. I mean, footnote 17, Supreme Court case, Exxon saying punitive damages are, you know, need to be tampered down. This is all about corporations being able to the corporation as a avenue to consolidate wealth and power that has been enabled by this corporate personhood form, by corporations usurping rights that were intended primarily for people.
So you're the constitutional amendment advocate, Ricky, yes?
I am, and what's happened here, I mean, it's very simple. When we started our country, people were property, right? That didn't go over very well. We had a civil war, we had civil rights amendments, we had a popular uprising. People, women didn't have equal rights. That also resulted in a popular uprising and a people's movement. And now the pendulum has swung from people are property to property is people. Okay? And what it's going to take to correct that is the same thing. Number one, people understanding how this lies at the heart of globalization and how this is destroying our small communities. And once people understand that, and our election process, and our republic, and everything else, once people understand that, then the simple fix is people made law, Trump's judge made law, and with a constitutional amendment, we could say corporation, we could separate corporation and state, and we could strip corporations of personhood and make pieces of property, which is
all
what
right.
they're supposed to be.
I want to get Mark Galanter's reaction to this notion here as a law professor, but first I want to go back to Tom, because I know you got to leave us again, Tom, but your position was essentially that we probably have adequate laws, but how are we ever going to get them properly enforced because there's conflict of interest. So what is your solution for it?
Well, there minimally has to be some sort of Chinese wall and an independent review standard to ensure that the scientific analysis is done properly for compliance of spill prevention and response plans. There's no doubt in my mind that not only is Ricky right about private corporate interests, but in particular, the state of Alaska is essentially in a separate class in that it is a corporate state, and then, you know, has this conflict between administering its budget and enforcing its laws, where it's an oil producer itself and obtains oil revenue from private interests.
Well, you know what would happen if you did that is you would just basically create a kind of a priesthood of regulation, and I can't even imagine how. I mean, once these, it's kind of like once the regulators have real power without check, you know, Lord knows what kind of mischief they get into. Pretty soon they're telling us how to tie our shoes. You know what I mean, Tom?
We have a good system. It's just not working, and it's not working because the pendulum has swung too far. I mean, we don't need to build any more, we don't need to heap any more fuel on this pyramid here. We need to undo it and get back to what we had back in 1776, you know, when we had our Constitution. Corporations
were not
persons.
But there weren't any corporations then. I mean...
Oh, yes, there were. That's why we fought.
Yeah, there were a few. There were a few by charter and so forth. But clearly the most human activity was not under the auspices of corporations the way it is now. And it seems to me... I mean, I like the idea of attacking the personhood, because it seemed to me that was a great mistake where we went off the rails in the 1870s when, after the Civil War amendments gave us equal protection and due process rights as a national right, the Supreme Court then said, that's for all persons, and corporations are persons, so they have all these rights, and we could strike down various attempts to regulate
them. So that's right around the same time as Plessy Ferguson.
No, well, yeah, a little before.
You see what it took to, we've discussed that extensively, what it took to undo Plessy Ferguson was a unanimous Brown versus Board of Education many, many years later. So the court itself corrected that. I wouldn't think there'd be any hope of that.
Well, the court, as prodded by the civil rights movement.
Yeah, but I mean, the courts will always reflect the society to some degree. I mean, that's kind of, you make that pretty clear. It just is kind of a drift. Tom Lockish, I want to thank you for joining us on the program.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, right now, without the independence of regulators, democracy is frustrated. We had legislators pass laws that aren't being enforced, and we might as well not pass them at all if we don't have independent regulation. And that's the ultimate question is, can our democracy survive without this type of independent regulation?
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
All right. Yeah, Ricky Ott, you, would you compare your two books, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, and Not One Drop, in terms
sure.
of the, I mean, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths is almost an encyclopedia.
Well, it was my revelation that oil is more toxic than we thought. I mean, and I thought I had to write an encyclopedia because I'm talking about oil, the source that we're using as our energy and treating like it's popcorn and completely safe to use, is actually what's coming out the tailpipes of our automobiles. Now, we know causes asthma in kids and causes cancer and causes in adults and causes heart attacks. And we didn't know this. We didn't have the tools to measure oil at these low levels back in the 1970s when the Clean Air and Clean Water Act passed. So Sound Truth is really hard science. It's about oil is more toxic than we thought to people and to animals. And part three, now what are we going to do? It's not only heating up the planet, it's poisoning us. Not One Drop is sort of the soft science, the sociology, the second teaching from the spill about disaster trauma and our litigation system and ultimately our democracy is in trouble. And how we as a community healed our trauma and what lesson that has for America now, where Cordova is essentially a mirror for the rest of America, where America has gone corrosive. We have a corrosive nation, blue states, red states, and I mean, I hope that the next president can help heal that, but we certainly learned a lot about healing this type of trauma in Cordova, and I think we can share that healing and how to bring communities together and focus on shared values and rebuild a common vision and take collective action. I mean, that's what we need to do.
So how are people responding to your idea of amending the Constitution?
I am floored. I have been on book tour now for 2 months, East Coast, West Coast, and in the middle, and I am getting standing ovations across the country. This just hits people as such a clear and simple thing. And people realize that the broken legal system that we have is a symptom of this greater broken democracy. Our campaign finance reform, same thing. These are all symptoms of this larger problem. And it's not about destroying the corporate form. I mean, it's like when we separated church and state. You know, churches aren't bad. Corporations aren't necessarily bad. What we're talking about here is rebalancing the power structure so that we make sure that people, human people, are the ultimate check and balance on our system of sovereign self-governance.
Mark Galanter, where do the advocates, what's the role of the advocates in here? I mean, there is this thing called public interest law, where people stand up for trees that have no standing and so forth.
Right. Well, let me respond to Ricky, because I certainly applaud this campaign to withdraw the cloak of personhood from corporations. But I just emphasize that that's really only the beginning of a redistribution of power. You can take away personhood, but at the moment, and all that really does is it says courts can't come in and intervene on behalf of corporations and say, well, they have these constitutional rights as persons. But the question is, how dependent are corporations on courts at this point when they basically own the legislatures and executives? That is, we have a campaign finance system that basically makes politicians in both executive and legislative very dependent on their corporate supporters. Now, in theory, if you remove personhood, you could regulate that flow of money, but it would still take a lot of doing once the personhood a question is addressed.
A lot of
As I say, I applaud the effort, but I just emphasize that it's really just the beginning.
I want to thank you for that comment. And let's stick with your First Amendment analogy with the campaign issues, because it's my understanding that when the First Amendment right of free speech fell to corporations, and by that I mean when the courts interpreted money as free speech, and
right.
Of course Exxon has $40 billion in net profit and way more money than, you know, I would ever hope to have. So that money is now sort of corrupting and influencing, you know, the campaign process.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea, but the idea here is that when we strip corporations of personhood, we retake all these amendments that were given to corporations. We take them back. So that, for example, the Fourth Amendment with warrantless searches. Corporations right now, you know, if you're a meatpacking industry, or you're, got some worker safety violations, perhaps, and OSHA wants to come in, or you've got environmental problems with a smokestack or a water discharge.
Mm-hmm.
EPA, the FDA, OSHA, none of them can come in without a warrant right now. So how many of these potential corporate criminals are you really going to catch if you have to issue a warrant? So the Fourth Amendment, you know, fell to these corporations. And I could go on and on. The Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, I could tell you. Yeah, I could tell you really dug into this, Ricky.
Well, I only dug into it because, you know, all of a sudden here comes the Exxon Valdez back to Prince William Sound with Exxon claiming the Fifth Amendment right of a taking of personal property. I'm like, what? How does a corporation claim, number one of our basic rights, and number two, what are they talking about, Fifth Amendment? And then I discover that, you know, the Fifth Amendment fell to corporations, and if you're threatening their future profit, then that can be challenged by the corporation. So here was Exxon saying, oh, excuse us, but it's costing us more money to operate the old Exxon Valdez in the Mediterranean, so we want to bring it back to Prince William Sound, and we're challenging the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 under the Fifth Amendment. And I'm like, hang on, let me look into this. So that's what happened.
Wow. They really want to bring it back?
Well, they did, but that's in not one drop, and it got shot down by Judge Holland, who I will say really did flip a switch here in his rulings after Exxon proceeded to attack the jury award. Holland really has written some quite radical comments in his briefings. I'm impressed.
Well, you know, the Mark Galanter, this business about juries, I mean, this was a... I'm kind of wondering what that Supreme Court ruling on the Exxon Valdez does to the jury system. I mean, this was a long trial. These people had to go through an awful lot of evidence and so forth, and they had to be very careful how they weighed all this. And they were instructed that you know, this is a big corporation, and you have you know, this is the purpose of punitive damages is deterrence, and and somehow the Supreme Court just disregarded all that and said, oh, it's maritime law. Well, let's see. Under maritime law, they can sort of make up whatever they wanted to then.
Well, I think what you've got here is a very dramatic instance, excuse me, of a very widespread phenomenon that appellate courts, which are, you know, made up of lawyers who, for the most part, have been advocates for corporations and had successful careers of that sort, and then they get appointed to the bench. And appellate courts are basically misguided in thinking that trial courts, and particularly juries, have a great pro-plaintiff bias. And therefore, these appellate judges tend to see their role as correcting this bias and offsetting it. And so there's been a couple of very fine studies which have shown that whereas judges in appellate courts tend to uphold almost all appeals where the defendant won below in the trial court. When it comes to cases where a jury has made an award to a plaintiff, and it can be a big punitive damages thing, or it can just be ordinary compensatory damages, the courts are much more suspicious of those awards and much more likely to overturn them. So I would say what we get in Exxon Valdez is this tendency to distrust juries kind of writ large, but it's certainly not unique to the Exxon case.
Dragged through the courts for almost 20 years, the Exxon Valdez damage award finally shows up at 1/10 of what was originally awarded by the jury. What do we do now? Is that enough, and what does that do for deterring corporations from cutting crews on tankers, which is what caused this thing to happen in the first place? Ricky Ott is with us. Ricky, you wanted to respond to Mark Galanter there on the subject of appellate courts coming to not trust juries.
Okay, so two points here. One on what you just said, and I'll just do that quickly first. And I want to point out, if $5 billion, which was the original jury award, had been sufficient to deter Exxon's behavior, then Exxon would have been the first corporation to double hull its tankers rather than the last.
Good point.
You know, and so what the Supreme Court has done is basically reduced it to where it's a mockery. It's less than four days of net profit right now. And that is not going to do diddly squat. And so I want to get back to now what Mark was mentioning, and pull out another amendment here. This is the Seventh Amendment. And this is, as I mentioned at the very beginning, facts tried by a jury cannot be retried by a higher court. And this is because 230 years ago, when our country was founded, people understood that our strength of our democracy comes in ordinary people judging ordinary people. It's not in the elite lawyers and all the theory and all the law. And so this was a Seventh Amendment right. It was considered so elemental and so fundamental to our democracy. So what has happened here is the jury, they didn't pull this $5 billion out of a hat. This was a fact. They sat down and they looked at how much money Exxon made, and they said, you know, what is it going to take to punish a corporation of this size? And they decided on 1 year's net profit at the time, which was $5 billion. So it had nothing to do with awarding that money to us. That we're talking apples and oranges here. The jury was saying, how do we punish Exxons, the Exxons of the world? So the jury linked punishment to profit. And that seems a very reasonable thing, because then you get a big corporation, you get a big punishment. You get a little corporation, you get a little, you know, a little littler punishment. It's to scale. And what the elite, educated, appellate court did was they broke that, and then the Supreme Court also broke it. The appellate court did it by just literally doing a huge injustice by taking $5 billion and simply cutting it in half. There is, and citing absolutely no law to do that, okay? I mean, for God's sakes, even the jury had an excuse of why they had a reason why they came up with $5 billion. The Ninth Circuit simply said it's time for this to be over and whacked it in half. Great. That's lovely. And then it goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, what they did was they really lost the plot. Instead of hitching profit to punishment, they hitched punishment to damages. Now, there's a huge problem there, because damages, it turns out, weren't total. What happened was our court case went to the jury in 1994. That was the very same year the very first ecosystem study got started. It took 10 years for those ecosystem studies to get the papers published to really conclude that the Exxon Valdez oil spill caused long-term harm. Well, that didn't count in the court of law. So we don't have whole harm. We've only been partially compensated.
Well, that's a really good point, Ricky. I want to go to the calls now. We got a lot of them from Angel by email at talk@APRN.org. The failure was in the judge's decision, not the lawyer's. I'm sure they didn't argue their case well enough to warrant the decision made. I would have to point out to Angel, who responded by email, that there is a that it was actually the jury that had to make the decision. And let's go to John, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John.
Hi, good morning. I'd just like to say that I think the decision made by the Supreme Court was inevitable for the fact that there's been a large history of spurious lawsuits preceding this case and where juries have basically awarded really ludicrous amounts of punitive damages to people that have sued. The legal system is broken, but rather than just blaming the corporations, we need to revamp it from day one. That's one reason why the appellate courts are pretty much ignoring juries anymore, because of large history of jury abuse. And that's all I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you, John. Mark Galanter, I know you would beg to differ with this.
I think this is a piece, an urban legend, that there's this great wave of jury abuse. First of all, punitive damages are awarded altogether in maybe 3% or 5% of the cases that plaintiffs win. And the interesting thing is, most of those cases are not tort cases, they're not cases of personal injury, they're contract cases, they're cases involving fraud, involving sometimes employment discrimination, and so forth. And for the most part, punitive damages are quite modest. They on the average are one or two times the typical award is anywhere from half the compensatory damages to two or three times it. So it's just very much an instance in which interest groups have used the occasional horror story, sometimes a true one, often a spurious one, to generate a lot of misinformation about punitive damages.
Yeah, and also Alaska jurors are known to be quite stingy on this. You know, they've run the numbers on that. I remember back in one of the early tort reform fusses, they said, "Are you kidding, Alaska juries?"
Yeah, well, actually, studies of juries show that juries, for the most part, tend first when a plaintiff comes in making a claim regarding injuries, to subject that plaintiff to intensive scrutiny, and it's only when the jury thinks that plaintiff is on the up and up that they're willing to compensate them. This notion that there are these kind of runaway juries that give you know, enormous awards to undeserving plaintiffs. I mean, there may be a few localities where there's more of that, but on the whole, that's really very far from a description of the American jury system.
That's Mark Galanter, professor of law emeritus, University of Wisconsin, and also with us, Ricky Ott, author of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. Ricky, you are one of the plaintiffs. Did you get a check yet?
Oh, I have no idea. I'm on book tour. But what I want to mention is one of the things here with this Supreme Court decision is that, of course, it's limited right now to a maritime port, but this one-to-one cap of punitive to compensatory, but the worry here is that this will be applied extensively to other cases and other branches of law. And what's the problem here is that it's, as Mark mentioned, it's only, you know, it's... This is urban legend, this myth of, you know, jury abuse. It happens very seldomly. But what we've lost is our threat of unlimited liability for large corporations. It's this threat of unlimited liability that holds these corporations accountable to our consumer safety laws, our environmental laws, our public health laws. So we, the people, cannot afford to have this tool taken away from us, and that is what the Supreme Court has done.
So you basically, you can't go down Tom's route of you know, let's just make sure our regulation really has teeth. You say when it comes to a certain point, you still have to have, you still have to be able to sue, and the corporations need to know that they can be sued.
I took a very, yes, I took a very interesting class, Democracy School, through Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org. And the veil was just ripped away from my eyes, and I realized it's not about regulations anymore. This is how the industry actually controls us, the people. I mean, look at it this way. They could, if they weren't, the corporations have permits that allow them to pollute. This is regulation. If they didn't have the permits, they couldn't pollute. So we are regulating, legally, pollution, you know.
Well, I hear mixing zones in there someplace.
Yeah, mixing zones, big loophole in the regulation. So it's a sort of a form of colonized mindset. We've gone down this route where, well, we can just make it parts per thousand, parts per million, parts per billion, and it will be okay. But really, it's a much bigger issue than that. And
wow.
The issue is who controls what, how the laws get made. And right now, that control has been tipped too far for corporations.
Well, you know, you came into this from a background, as I recall, sediment biochemistry, is that right?
Yes, marine toxicology, marine pollution.
Right. And did you have any idea in your wildest imagination that Auk Bay would come up with what they came up with in terms of how toxic the heavy fractions were? I mean, that was a mind-blower, don't you think?
Right when I left graduate school in 1985, I had just gotten my doctorate, PAHs were the new buzzword, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and the mixed function oxidase system. In other words, we had a biomarker that we had sophisticated technology to be able to handle for the first time. We could measure PAH, very low levels of oil, in organisms, people, animals, birds, fish. And I knew that that was going to open up a whole new field of learning how toxic things were at much lower levels. And in fact, that is what happened. And that was one reason my partner and I, did not work on the oil spill. We were very concerned about what it might do to our health. And by the way, I just came back from South Korea, and for their one-year anniversary of the Hebei Spirit oil spill, their university there got on that spill in a day and a half, did a very extensive study on worker health, and have documented not only respiratory damage in children, in women, in men, but also chromosomal aberrations, DNA damage from working on oil spill cleanup and simply breathing the fumes.
Yeah, people who want to know more about that sort of thing, which is largely unreported by the press, it's in Ricky's first book, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths. Ricky Ott is one of our guests, along with law professor Mark Galanter, who collects lawyer jokes, and I don't think we're not going to get to a single lawyer joke, which is really too bad, you know, but I was kind of hoping for at least one. But let's go to Larry, who joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Larry.
Yeah, hello. I'd sure like to compliment Ricky on the good work she's done down there in Cordova. We've been down there and met with her, and it's just great. I would like to suggest a public monitor for the amendment that might help people understand it in simple terms. That is the separation of the fox from the hen house.
That's almost as good as the property has become people.
Yeah, and the bridge to nowhere helped a lot, too.
Right, Larry. Thank you
so
much.
Hey, Larry, spread the word, please, that I'll be in Fairbanks December 4th, Unitarian Church, I think, 7:30, I think.
Okay, be glad to.
Coming right up,
thank
and you're
you.
Also doing the Muckrakers Ball, right, at Chilkoot's here in Anchorage.
In Anchorage on December 6th, yes.
Yeah, so you're hopping right around there, book tour. Yes.
Could I maybe take us back to the general question of how you control corporate behavior
And it seems to me there are two basic alternatives. One is try and do it before it happens with regulation, or do it afterwards with litigation, which will create a precedent that people will worry about next time, or they'll worry about it in the threat of it. And it seems to me that what we've seen in this country is, in the kind of political system we have, there's a limit to how much you can do with regulation, just because the regulators are people with careers and ambitions, and they're in an environment where there's a lot of good things that could flow their way from the people they're supposed to be regulating. And so we've tended to rely much more than any place else in the world on litigation, after the fact, coming in and coming in with consequences that will make people think the next time. And punitive damages, as Ricky has argued, has certainly been an important part of that. And I think also another important feature has been juries, to have decision makers who don't have careers as decision makers, who don't develop relationships of dependence with the people they're supposed to be judging and monitoring.
Well, it's kind of the way you're saying it. It only sounds like it's just part of the way the Constitution was set up. It was supposed to be that way, Mark Galanter. I want to get to some more calls, I want to make sure that you've made your point.
Yeah, no, I have, and I think it is part of the genius of the Constitution.
And I agree with that. And what I'd like to add to that is, it doesn't lock us. I think we need to take another look at our legal system and say, is this really working for all the parties, the harmed parties, the people who caused the harm? And if it's not, because there's so stacks of sociologist papers, psychologist papers, psychiatrist papers saying, hey, this adversarial legal system isn't necessarily a ticket. And where I go to in Not One Drop is more toward restorative justice and mediated settlements rather than duking it out, gloves off.
Having read Mark Galanter, you're pretty much on board with that too, aren't you?
Well, because it seemed to me, Ricky, you were invoking before the powerful threat generated by the punitive damages and by the possibility of legal liability. And it seems to me, if you want that threat to work, you can't take the edge off it by abandoning adversariness and saying, well, let's get everybody in a room and get them to agree.
It's the threat that drives people to a mediated settlement. I mean, if the corporations really understand that they are going to be held accountable to what we called non-economic harm in the Exxon Valdez case, the sociology study in Cordova proved that we can actually count this now and measure quality of life harm, and that it should be counted. So, you know, the cost of these accidents can increase astronomically. And so with this threat of large punitive damage awards, with this threat of unlimited liability, with this threat of actually having to pay for whole harm and long-term harm, that could drive, I think, a more saner situation of where you sit down and you figure it out.
Bring them to the table.
Yeah,
thank you, Ricky.
Yeah, they only come to the table when the alternative is worse.
Go to Guy, joins the program from Valdez. Welcome to Talk Alaska, Guy.
Yeah, that guy that shot the holes in the pipeline. How much time is he doing? How much of a fine did he get? I would have liked to seen those guys at, you know, those corporate guys in Exxon. I wish they would have had the threat of going to jail themselves. I mean, how much oil did this guy cost with his gunshots compared to what they put in Prince William Sound here? And I'm going to take my answers off the air. And Ricky, keep pounding your head against the wall, because that's what it's going to be about.
It took quite a lot of shots before he got exactly the right angle to get that bullet through that pipeline, too. Yeah. How about that, Ricky? Personal responsibility for corporate officers. Every once in a while, that one comes up. Did they become immune at some point when I didn't realize it?
I believe so, but I'm not sure about that. Mark, can you answer that? And luckily, I have a hard head. So,
they're not exempt from criminal statutes, but there aren't many criminal statutes about, say, oil spills and other things. I mean, I suppose there may be some criminal negligence things, but obviously prosecutors rarely pursue them. On financial shenanigans, they sometimes do, but once in a while you get like a factory manager being held criminally responsible for the death of a worker, etc. I mean, it does happen.
Often they'll have errors in emission insurance, so it all goes back into
the
financial services industry.
It's just a financial thing.
Yeah. Let's go to Teresa. Teresa joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Teresa.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to thank National Public Radio and all the people out there that helped clean up that oil spill, and the lawyers that have been fighting, and legislators. You know, there's a whole bunch of people I want to thank. And I just wanted to say that there's someone who had been a permit holder in the Kodiak area that has been told, you know, you're not going to be able to get the payment this round because you have a back tax bill. The person was paying on the tax bill,
not enough for the authorities, though, huh?
Well, for the lawyers, they have to make payments to the people who have a clean, easy to work case right now. And I know that person is facing homelessness, and they're, after they sold their permit in the early 90s, they gradually became disabled, and they're on low fixed income. And the irony is that the back tax bill that they had that prevented them from getting any payment this round, it was from self-employment tax from the last little Exxon settlement of 2003, and now they're not going to have to pay self-employment tax on this new settlement payment.
There are stories like this across the entire oil spill region. I personally know people in Cordova whose individual share of the reduced award will not even cover their bankruptcy lawyer. I mean, people have to file bankruptcy, and it's not even enough to pay for bankruptcy filings. I mean, that's how pathetic this settlement, this award is right now.
Teresa, thanks for your call. It really gave us a ground truth feeling. And,
Say one more thing.
Yeah, sure. Quickly, though.
I have a short-tail relative there in the Cordova area that has told years ago about coming across an oil spill in his tender. I know if I said the name of the person, Ricky would know him right away, and I don't have his permission to say that, but I just remember that he said he never had seen such a miles-long oil spill. He turned it into the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard just, you know, said, forget it. We're not dealing with it. I wondered if people are aware of that happening.
I know a lot more than I put into these two books. Let me just leave it at
right.
that.
Do you think Mark Galanter, isn't there a place for public vigilance here? I mean, it just seems to me like we had the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and then somehow we get another spill up in the North Slope, And once again, it's because the corporation wasn't doing its job in maintenance. And somehow we didn't know.
Citizen oversight has been the biggest, I think, improvement from the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. And there was a political compromise because at the time that that passed, because we had tried to get citizen oversight of the whole Trans-Alaska pipeline. And that is still what we're trying to do.
Yeah, well, they quickly took the RCACs and weakened them, and so we won't see anything quite like that again. Ricky, I want to thank you so much. Hope you have a good time at the ball and the book signings.
All right, thank you.
Mark Comanche, nice meeting you. So much for putting your legal light on this. It was very enjoyable. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So here we are, the Exxon Valdez oil spill almost 20 years later, people finally getting their checks. It's Talk of Alaska, Gooseberry Peter on the controls, Len Anderson on the phones, Duncan Moons, our managing editor, and I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.